If the court would reserve for me 3 minutes, please.
3 minutes, sure.
Thank you, Judge O'Brien. Please the court, I am Robert Bruce, an assistant public defender for Loudoun, Rappahannock, and Fauquier counties, here for the appellant, Rosangeles Bradley. And this case presents the issue of whether or not the trial court errs when it concludes that a malicious homicide, a first-degree murder, occurred, notwithstanding the Alford plea, the conviction to manslaughter, and a joint proffer of facts by both the prosecution and the defense that all explained, expounded, justified, and concluded that a manslaughter had occurred.
In manslaughter, there's a range of penalty that's available. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there might be certain facts which would warrant penalty at the low end, certain facts which would warrant penalty at the high end.
Of course, Your Honor. Yes.
And in this case, didn't the trial judge determine, after having considered all the facts, including the defense evidence, that the facts warranted penalty at the high end?
In fact, Your Honor, and thank you, Judge O'Brien, for pointing this out, but in fact, what the court concluded that there was a premeditated and malicious killing. It's not that the court concluded that the kind of killing that occurred in this, or the facts and circumstances surrounding, say, the victim or the defendant in this case, warranted a penalty at the high end. In this case, the court said that it was a premeditated and malicious killing. And
it's that. Was there anything inaccurate about that representation?
There was no malice, Your Honor. We'll frankly concede.
There might not be legal malice, but isn't there factual malice?
No, Your Honor, respectfully. In fact, the case law is very clear that if where there's a manslaughter, it precludes there from being any malice. That a person acting out of the furor brevis, this anger, this rage, or this fear.
This was truly what I. And I don't like the term, but this looks like it was a plea bargain in every respect. And clearly, there was evidence here, if believed by the prior fact, that would have established premeditation and malice. Apparently, there was also evidence here that would have supported a heat of sudden passion manslaughter. The Commonwealth chose to offer the defendant a deal. But that deal, while it may have changed the legal issues involved, didn't change the factual issues of the case. And here the court was simply commenting upon the fact that this woman went upstairs, got a gun, test fired it, came down, and shot her husband twice. I don't see why those facts don't justify the court imposing the maximum sentence.
I think I understand where Your Honor is going, Judge Petty, and it gets to this issue where there's evidence of premeditation, even strong evidence of premeditation, does it support malice? And the answer is no. Premeditation is a neutral fact with respect to malice, and that's clear from the case law down below. And I would certainly, I'm sorry, the case law from the court, and I would commend to the court's attention the cases of Couture versus Commonwealth and Rhodes versus Commonwealth, which are cited in our brief. And the notion is that, and in fact, actually, I think the right case on point is the Miller versus Commonwealth, which we cited in the brief. And this is a case where it overturned the conviction for a second-degree murder, stating that the defendant was entitled to a heat of passion instruction. This was an unlawful wounding case. And where the defendant had been attacked by the victim, 2 to 3 minutes occurs. During those 2 to 3 minutes, he has to be restrained by the passersby. He's asking for somebody in a bystander for a gun, gets the gun from the bystander, checks to make sure that it's loaded, walks toward the victim in that case, and then discharges the firearm. And notwithstanding all of those steps that were along the way, all of those evidence of premeditation, as I think Your Honor is pointing out, there was certainly, he was still acting under the furor brevis, or at least that was something that the jury could consider. And in this case, very similarly, we have not 60 seconds before, a minute before, we have her husband of 10 years, a police-trained officer who is bigger than her, stronger than her in every way, takes her and tries to twist her head off in her words, or puts her into a chokehold, and but for the presence of their 9-year-old, would not necessarily have stopped. And the court can see from all of the citations that he's done in the sentencing memorandum that correlates extraordinarily highly with future deadly violence, that it was, from any objective standard, reasonable that she was threatened and her life was threatened. And
yeah,
underneath this...
For a second, didn't the trial judge say that he considered all those things, that he considered the sentencing memoranda and, in fact, the testimony of some of the defense witnesses at sentencing?
He did, Your Honor.
So you're saying that despite that, he abused his discretion in imposing the sentence?
By committing the mistake of law of concluding, notwithstanding that evidence, that malice had occurred, where both parties gave all of the evidence to the court, where it substantiated the furor brevis of manslaughter.
And where was the objection to his ruling noted?
There was a 40-page, as the court can see from the record, 40 pages of counsel's argument stated it and concluded.
That's before that. Before you rule.
Correct.
After he rules. Once he rules, where is that objection?
There was no objection after he ruled, Your Honor. And this was certainly brought up by the opposing counsel's brief, Your Honor. But as the court can see from...
Let's talk about a different line of cases. And that's a line of cases that's... Because the only limitation on the judge's sentencing power imposed by the parties with their agreement was he had to do it within the statutory range, by definition. And he did it within the statutory range, correct?
Your Honor, as long as he didn't commit a mistake of law, the only requirement is that he does it within the statutory range.
There are any number of cases from the Virginia Supreme Court that say that, so we will not entertain an argument that a judge abused his discretion if he sentences within the statutory range. As recently as 3 weeks ago in Due, the court said that Virginia used the rule that, quote, adheres to the, quote, general proposition that once it is determined that a sentence is within the limitations set forth in the statute under which it is imposed, appellate review is at an end.
Due is a perfect example of exactly what we're speaking about, Judge Russell. Because the court did, in fact, go on to decide whether or not there was an abuse of discretion in this case for putting a lifelong no-contact provision against the mother-in-law in that particular case. And the issue was then is, notwithstanding that this penalty, right, was well within the norms, was there nevertheless a mistake of law as defined by those factors that were elucidated by Murray, right, in their line of cases that was then applied by Due, which is where a trial court makes a mistake of law, so to speak, when it either takes a... it disregards a substantial factor that should have been given great weight, it disregards... regards a factor that should have been disregarded, or commits an error in judgment. And so that's exactly the point here, and this is what distinguishes the Abdo line of cases that says if it's just an unreasonable sentence from the cases that go to the Murray line, which is it's about the mistake of law.
In that case, then, and tell me, if you had already answered that, I think when Judge Russell asked you a question, you had finished answering my question about Rule 5A18. Had you finished?
I had not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But,
I'm sorry. That's all right. Would you go ahead?
Of course, Your Honor. And I would just point out from Virginia Code Section 8.01, that there's no formulaic approach to preserving error. Formal exceptions to rulings or orders of the court shall be unnecessary, but for all purposes in which an exception has heretofore been necessary, it shall be sufficient that a party at the time of a ruling or order of the court is made or sought, makes known to the court the action which the person desires. And so we argued down below that this was not just a manslaughter, but a minimally culpable manslaughter. The court, notwithstanding that argument, made a determination that it was a malicious murder in that particular case. And so we would contend, as we cited to in both Lynn, U.S. versus Lynn, a Fourth Circuit case, that there was to continue to object was simply to complain about the court ruling after it made its ruling. And certainly Lee versus Lee talks about the methodology of how a preservation of error can occur and just bringing it up in sentencing arguments and having the court rule adversely. Preserves the error, preserves the issue, and gives notice to the court making a decision down below.
Why is this a miscarriage? Why is this sentence a miscarriage of justice if it falls within the range of punishment that the court was authorized to impose?
Thank you, Your Honor. Because the court misinstructed itself on exactly how it could find it. It misconcluded it that a malicious killing occurred here, where all the evidence. either substantiated that manslaughter was there or at best was neutral, right? Where it went to say premeditation, but not necessarily to whether or not she had in her head a malice or fear. And the other things unequivocally explained it, like the fact that that Stephen Spratling had assaulted her, nearly brought her to unconsciousness.
But would you agree that had the trial court not made that statement, you wouldn't have any argument presented? If the trial court had simply said, I sentence you 10 years in penitentiary.
Our basis of the evidence, as we put into our memorandum, is both that statement that the court said verbally in announcing the decision, the written statement to that effect that was written in the reason for departure from the guidelines to just underscore that, and also just as it happens, the maximal sentence that isn't per se unreasonable, so I believe that that's the concession that Your Honor is looking for, but is it also evidence that the court certainly disregarded and was giving weight to the court's conclusion that this was a malicious one, malicious murder.
To overlook 5AP, we have to say that not that a miscarriage of justice might have occurred, but a miscarriage of justice did in fact occur. And I can see it quite possible that if you put this same case in front of a number of different judges, you might end up with the same sentence. And so I find it difficult to say that this is so egregious that a miscarriage of justice actually, in fact, occurred.
And Your Honor, if I may ask the court, is the court stating and holding as a proposition in the court's question that we did not preserve the error below by bringing the court's attention?
You asked for application of the exception to 518.
To the extent that it's necessary, Your Honor, we've asked for the application of 518. But that's with regard to our argument that if the court is interpreting 19.2 to 98.01F as a bar to this particular appeal, as it has been done in the past in cases like Woodard, where we're bringing a sentencing issue before the court and they say that where, as here, the issue is with the government.
Did you raise to the trial court that it erred because it considered the elements of malice and premeditation in terms of punishment?
Your Honor, I see my time has elapsed.
Here to rebuttal. If you'd like to answer that, or if you want to come back and answer that rebuttal.
I'll just quickly, it's the same answer that I would have given Judge O'Brien, and there was 40 pages of argument talking about this as a manslaughter. Everything supported this was a manslaughter.
That was the judge made the statements that you find to be objectionable.
The court made it clear that the court was misconcluding, that it was committing a mistake of law in its process.
Okay.
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is Rosemary Moore on behalf of the Appellee of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I think it's very important to note here, first of all, what is the issue before this court that has been preserved? And I think it's interesting that this has been construed as a mistake of law, because the assignment of error in this case, which is how parties frame the issues, the first assignment of error says, in light of the facts and the circumstances surrounding his death and the evidence relating to Ms. Spradling's history and background. Nowhere in that assignment of error, or frankly at trial, was this mistake, this egregious, as it's been phrased, mistake of law that the court considered something that it should not have considered. Was that ever mentioned? So the court here was not given a chance to address this issue. If counsel believed that the court was considering facts that it could not consider, or issues that it could not consider, and that was an abuse of discretion, then those issues had to be raised at trial in some manner. I would note also that the sentence here obviously was within the statutory maximum. And from a long line of cases, I believe Abdo being the primary case, and since then repeatedly, the Supreme Court has said that as long as a sentence is within the statutory maximum, it will not be an abuse of discretion, will not be found to be an abuse of discretion. And that is the specific issue relating to sentencing, the specific ruling that pertains to abuse of discretion as it pertains to sentencing range. And, of course, what we've had here is this argument that, no, this more general rule that talking about what is an abuse of discretion in all sorts of issues, not just sentencing issues, but admissibility of evidence and so forth, that more broad rule of law should trump the specific rule, which has been longstanding, that as long as the sentence is within the statutory maximum, that will not be overturned as an abuse of discretion, without any authority to back that up. And, of course, the Murray case that's cited on appeal by counsel does not pertain to some additional thing of a requirement put in there for Fourth Amendment waiver. These are not the same issues as discussing what can be weighed insofar as what are the factors that go to sentencing. And I cited the court to a number, as to the merits of this case, to a number of cases where, you know, unadjudicated matters can be considered. And even an out-of-state case that was very much on point with the same sort of argument. So there's a long line of cases that the court can consider all of the facts before it. Even in this the argument is made that there was this very long memorandum and agreed proffer. But on page 29 of defense counsel's memorandum, they said, and the court pointed to this, that the defendant knew when she went upstairs that she was going to kill him before she got the gun. So that was even in their memorandum, that she had that notion in her mind before she went upstairs, methodically got the firearm, test fired it, and then went down, told her children to go up and hide, essentially, and then went downstairs and killed her husband. So the court is not required, just because there's been a plea bargain in a case, to disregard the facts that are before it. And certainly it is within the court's discretion to weigh those facts in the manner that it concludes is appropriate. There was no error here committed by the court, and there was no objection to what the court stated was its reasons for reaching its decision. And I would note here that the court methodically went through all of the issues that are raised in the assignment of error and that were raised in the memorandum in support, including the testimony from the various doctors and the articles that were presented, and said that he very carefully weighed those issues, but this was the sentence that he chose to reach. Now, with regard to the due process argument, this is putting up a straw man to knock it down, because the assignment of error doesn't mention the guidelines, doesn't mention any guidelines error in this case. This is a run-of-the-mill, is this sentence outside the statutory maximum abuse of discretion kind of case. So the assignment of error doesn't say that there's been some problem with the guidelines and how they were calculated. And so this isn't an issue, and to say that this is somehow a violation of due process when it isn't the issue that's before the court, I mean, there's no way to resurrect that if that's not the issue that's before the court as a live issue. So unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That last issue, do you believe that 90.22.98.01 bars appellate review of the sentence?
No, Your Honor. Not at all.
It seems to me all it does is bar appellate review of whether the trial judge was required to sentence within the guideline range.
We agree entirely with that interpretation. And there was an unpublished opinion that was relatively recently decided by this court.
You're getting your appellate review of the sentence. It's not of your appellate review of the judge's decision to deviate.
Correct, Your Honor. In fact, it's very specific to the procedure that the sentence was arrived at. Whether the court committed an error by disregarding substantial facts that should have been accorded great weight and committing a clear error in judgment.
If the trial judge had said, based on all the facts that were provided to me by the parties, you were wise to accept this plea bargain, I would have found you guilty of first-degree murder. And for that reason, that I believe that that's what the facts actually support, I'm saying she is the maximum manslaughter penalty. Because that's my interpretation of the facts. Would that be a problem?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's the same situation. It's the court misconcluding on the evidence that there was sufficient evidence of malice where it wasn't proven here, where the parties have agreed of all of the facts that substantiate the furor brevis that created the action, that 60 seconds before this, the deadly attack on Rosangela Spradley, how this is the first time such an attack, apparently from the record, had occurred in their 10 years of marriage, how their detente was upset, right? 10 years of a semi-abusive relationship that from now and again police would come, but there weren't any obvious injuries or anything like that. That was all upset that night when he applied that amount of force, and she said she knew, that's true. She knew that she would end his life at that point, and then took the intentional actions. Thus, this is a voluntary manslaughter case. Took the intentional actions to end his life, but nevertheless did so under all of the reasons that support being afraid and being angry or some combination of both. But whereas here we have only these ambiguous facts that, if taken in isolation, could support a finding of malice, the court disregarded all of the other agreed upon facts in order to make that finding.
What sentence do you believe was not then abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, Judge Betty, I want to thank you for the question, but I can't answer that. It's not my job. Frankly, it's for a trial court to make that decision.
Could it be 15?
I'm sorry?
Could it be 15?
Of course, anything within the statutory limit provided. Provided it was arrived at without a mistake of law. Provided, gets to my opposing counsel's notion that there's a general versus a specific kind of case law, which is not in fact the case. There are two lines of cases, and they both in fact go back to Messer versus Commonwealth in 1926. A case that reversed a maximum sentence of 6 months that had been imposed by a jury for possession of whiskey spirits. It's cited in our reply brief. And the court, in finding that it was to be remanded, it was because it appears from the maximal sentence that the jury had disregarded the instructions that were given to it about how they could not impose jail time if they found it was an inadvertent break of law. But then it made that position that has been cited since all the way up into Abdo and certainly being cited today, that we would not disturb any sentence as long as it's within the statutory limits, unless there's a mistake of law.
Thank you. I'm trying to give you enough time to finish.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll come to your chat.